C1AN. Number 6B.
Now we come to the sixth subject of truth. This sixth subject, I think I could epitomize it like this. You may have another epitome, that animal magnetism is a wrong consciousness. It has a lot to do in here about wrongness and rightness, about justice and sentencing, all about courts and juries, all that has to do with right and wrong. And I feel that what you want to show is that animal magnetism is really nothing else but a wrong consciousness. And therefore, naturally, that the remedy for it is that it's to have a divine consciousness to do right. That to do right really protects us from doing wrong. And if we are not doing wrong, we jolly well are very happy and safe. And in this way also, by showing that animal magnetism is a wrong consciousness, she also wants to show that animal magnetism is always wrong and should in no way be justified. That it shouldn't be justified. Because here the great subject of theodicy is introduced, and it seems that the whole subject is under that caption of theodicy. Theodicy is, according to Webster, comes from theos, which is God, and dike, which is right. Therefore, the rightness of God means the righteousness and rightness and justice of God. Webster says it is a vindication of the justice of God, especially in ordaining or permitting natural and moral evil, a term originated by Leibniz, who endeavored to prove, this is very interesting, who endeavored to prove that the world as it is the best conceivable world, and the existence of evil is as necessary a condition of the existence of the greatest moral good. The general sense of theodicy, or the righteousness of rightness of God, is a belief that the existence of evil is necessary to bring out the maximum of good, and that God lets evil exist for the sake of good, and that in order to bring out in us the best, that evil must exist. Well, naturally, that is a very, very, very old belief that goes right from Job up to our days. I think the whole play of Goethe, Faust, perhaps you have heard of that well-known play of Faust, is all a big composition, how God lets evil exist in order to bring out the best in men. That's the usual concept of theodicy. And against that concept of theodicy, Mrs. Eddy puts up the theodicy of Christian Science. She says Christian Science goes to the bottom of mental action and reveals the theodicy which indicates the rightness of all divine action as the emanation of the divine mind and the consequent wrongness of its opposite action. She does not justify evil in any way. That's a big point, which we have to see, that truth is that term for God, which asks the wholeness of God and does not justify anything next to God. Whereas all theology does. All theology says, well, it is in the will of God that he sends you sickness, because he wants to prove you and wants to try you and see if you are a good Christian and if you have hope and faith and perseverance and so on. It's always in the general human mind, there is still a great lot left of this false sense of theodicy, namely that good uses evil to bring out more good, the best in us. And against this, Mrs. Eddy draws the sword and puts up that new sense of the Odyssey, which is so clear and pure and scientific in logic, namely that either something is right or it isn't right. If God is truth, that then only that which is of the nature of God is true, and everything that is not of the nature of God must not be true, and therefore cannot be an instrument or a channel or an element of God. So mental action is here presented, described, as that it can be right or wrong. That mental action can be either right or wrong. All divine mental action is always right, and therefore all other mental action, whatever that is, human action, karma mind action, is always wrong. And so we don't need to try to justify it. Then she goes on to truth of spirit and showing that divine mentality works always good, whereas the animal consciousness makes the case always worse, even if for a time it seems that it can relieve a situation. Then Sachi makes it clear that that is only the case of the greater error overcoming the lesser error. So again we see in spirit comes always in the tone of good, in the subtone, the tone of good, showing that in the measure as we resort to truth as mind, as the divine mind, as the point from which we try to think, from the point of which we try to act, that if we start from that point, that leads us always to truth of spirit, namely that is always good. That we don't have to fear that this will have an evil effect. But on the other side, it also unmasks to us animal magnetism, which is unmasked to see that everything which starts not from the divine mind, whatever that mind professes to be, will always be evil, no matter what the transitional effects seem to show forth. It is always evil. You see, science asks a lot of trust it asks a lot of trust in its principles. Science is always against sense testimony. It's always science against sense testimony. And the sense testimony may always testify something different. And if we ask sense testimony how right or wrong science is, then we are always going out from a false standpoint. But if we go out from a scientific standpoint, then we must be careful never to ask sense testimony if our deduction and if our basis in science is right or wrong. Because sense testimony can testify pro and con, both. It's always dualistic. Can testify pro and con. Just here, as she says, well, the hypnotizer employs one error to destroy another. If he heals sickness through a belief, if he heals sickness, well, healing is healing. We say, well, that's wonderful. I could see it. I could feel it. I feel much better. I feel healed. That must be good. Well, that's going out from my feelings, and that's not science. This science has something very deep and very... It needs courage to be a scientist. It needs an enormous lot of courage to be a scientist, because science is never supported by sense testimony. It can, but it cannot. It must not. And so every resort on sense testimony is a false resorting for a proof of science, always. Science is something very pure, very pure, very, very exalted. If one touches science in any subject where one starts from a premise in science which one knows is right and deduces from that science and don't waver, doesn't go to the right or to the left, and is pure and consistent in its working out, then it needs courage. It's an enormous lot of courage. until that science has worked its idea out to the seventh stage. Because on the way, sense testimony can approve or disapprove, but it can never give a proof of its rightness or wrongness. That's the theodicy of Christian science. Science is wonderful, but it has no support in sense testimony. No, not whatever. So having shown that first going out from mind, that we can be sure that it's always right, then my truth of spirit showing that this rightness is always good and works out only good, and that we can be sure that it works out only good, then she shows how, therefore, the motive or the starting point, the mind mentality, is really the essential one, because motives govern acts, and that the motive counts and not the act by itself. Because motive determines acts, the motive counts. And she shows here how the motive, that without a motive the hand will not act. How matter, therefore, is not that which has to be judged in the next zone of truth as principle, but that the motive must be judged. That the mentality, not the act, must be judged. So often we say that, and it's certainly good that we say the motive counts, and not what the act then has been shown. If the motive is right, then the act will show them itself in the last run to be right too. But she naturally shows that if the motive counts and not the act, that brings up a very difficult problem for the courts and the juries, because you can see the act, but can you see the motive? And so she says, quite rightly, the courts try to find out the motive of an act and judge and sentence according to the motive. But then she says, but in the case of malpractice, what can you do then? If there is a person A who silently and malpractices on the person B, that B kills C, the person C. Well, the act is there that B kills C, and the courts will hold justice on the person B. But the person A will not be judged. He will be unpunished, because nobody can find out his silent arguments and motives. And in Mrs. Eddy's time, a student of Mrs. Eddy tried to bring such a malpractitioner before the court, but the court rejected. They said, well, we cannot prove, first of all, we cannot prove that the person E has been malpracticing. Second, we cannot prove that malpractice had the power and the influence big enough for the person B to do that wrong act. And so the court didn't want to do anything with that case. And that's what is in mind in Mrs. Eddy when at the end of that paragraph she begins to talk how metaphysics is just as important in handling such cases as it is in another subject. That only metaphysics can judge such a case. We see that more and more that the real culprit will more and more be out of reach of the court and of human law. And that divine law and that the working of divine law must find out the culprit, and the culprit, as we go on, is shown that he always will find the divine penalty. And that metaphysics can help to hold crime in check. One of the first penalties that the malpractitioner, which cannot be judged by the court, will find is that malpractice is by itself destructive. And so in the tone of truth of life, she shows how the misuse of mental powers is self-destructive. That it that God will arrest him, and divine justice, not human justice, divine justice will manacle him. His sins will be millstones round about his neck, weighing him down to the depths of ignominy and death, and the aggravation and so on. You see how truth has life. Truth is life. And so truth has life. Well, everything which is not of the nature of truth has no life, therefore it has death in itself. So everything which is of a wrong mentality, of a wrong motive, has the germ of death in itself, the germ of self-destruction already in itself. See? And that's the law which we have to see and which we have to uphold. And then we also see how the silent and mental malpractitioner falls by its own motive, by its own virtue. And then finally, truth is truth. She shows, because that malpractice is destructive, it is no help for mankind, that it does not elevate the standard of mankind, but that it's debasing, that it puts him from the platform of common manhood into the very mire of iniquity and works against. So we'll see how malpracticing, how wrong motive, how harboring in oneself anything which is not in line with the standard of truth is degrading our manhood in each one of us. And we only gather the fullness and stature of true manhood in the way as we are at one with truth. That's very clear. And finally, she says in Truth and Love that mentally trespassing on God-given rights incurs divine penalty. She begins to see that there is a bigger justice and a higher justice than the human court. And it's so often good to remember that, because today, in every country where I see, perhaps not so much in England, they always say that the courts in England and the law in England is really still good and unbridled. The judges are, jurors are unbridled, you say? Unbiased, yes, and that you can't bribe them. Well, I don't know many countries where that is true. Anyway, even in Switzerland, we are called to be a good nation, and I don't know what, but I don't trust anymore any of the courts in Zurich. I don't trust them anymore. There is too much going on in the back, and friends backing on their shoulder and patting their backs, and so human righteousness is always insufficient. I think the age will come where we will find out that more and more that only divine righteousness, that only the divine penalty, the divine sentence is asked for. And that we don't ask anymore for human righteousness and for being justified humanly. I don't think that's any more possible. After all, we can't go to the court for every little thing which is humanly unjust and humanly not right. And we jolly well have to go and find our divine rights and our divine manhood, and to have that self-government with reason and with conscience, where we are satisfied with a good conscience within ourselves by doing right. Where we find our self-government by governing ourselves under the laws of God and don't mind what the other fellow thinks and does. More and more we come to that point where men's rights are invaded when the divine order is interfered with. When the divine order is interfered with. How can you interfere with the divine order? Oh, I can interfere with the divine order only in one way. By trespassing on the order of the world. That's the divine order. The human order is not meant with it. It's the divine order. And so, whenever I trespass on the divine order, I get my penalty. With court, without court, I get it anyway. And usually one gets it more without a court. The pangs of neglect, bad conscience of having done something wrong or ignorantly, also is much more severe than paying 50 francs to a court and having it over. And that's good. That God's government is taking hold of men. That the divine theodicy is taking hold of men, which always judges all that is wrong and sentences all that is wrong, but establishes in us all that is right. And then finally, we come to the last big subject of love. And in that last big subject of love, we find a very simple final statement, just saying that in Christian Science, really, there is no such thing as animal magnetism. That living in science, that we are, that against such is no law. First of all, in Lover's Truth, she again points out that if we sanction, you see, sanction means to render sacred. If we sanction only that which is demonstrable in truth, then, according to Galatians, then we can inherit the kingdom of God. And nothing can stand us in the way of salvation. That no animal magnetism can hinder that we inherit the kingdom of God, that we take possession of our true inheritance. Then in Lover's Love she says, and against such there is no law. Against such there is no law. That's how she ends the whole chapter. Wonderful. See, once one has just seen in consciousness through that whole claim of animal magnetism and has reduced it to the point where he begins to see it is a belief, an illusion, and then in love begins to fill one's consciousness with all that is true, then we inherit truth, and in that consciousness, against that, there is no law, and wipe it out. Well, here we stop, and this afternoon we will go over that whole subject from various angles.